need to hide first. I'm going to take a moment. Let me cover myself in soap so nobody can see me.
Sounds like bullying.
Kind of.
Hearing these stories absolutely changed my life.
No, but for real. And I think in a lot of cases, like, legitimate concerns that people have where they're actually like, I am here in treatment because I want to recover. Mm-hmm. I'm desperately trying.
Welcome to Eating Disorders Off Topic. Thanks for giving us some time out of your day. I am Adam Pope, sitting here in chilly but beautiful Minneapolis, across from my co-host, the always incisive and knowledgeable Joy Nolenberg from The Joy Project. Good afternoon.
Thanks, Adam. Back and ready for episode 2. How have you been?
New baby and new home. It's been really busy. I was worried about the baby because partly worried about being in recovery, and the main thing was, is there like a genetic component to eating disorders? What's the deal with that? Also, am I feeding her enough? Am I not feeding her enough? If she grows older, what are portion sizes I should use? I'm worried about her not having an eating disorder problem. I want to do it right, and I want to do it perfectly, and I want her to be self-assured and confident. And it's been 3 months, and I'm not sure if she's hit those goalposts yet. So there's a lot going on, and I've got some pretty wonderful friends in the eating disorder community that are kind of going through the similar thing as well. So I'm sure we'll talk about that again at some future date, but it's definitely something that's in my mind right now. She's doing a bottle. She's wonderful. She's a baby doing her thing. You know, in the future, it just kind of gets on the back of my brain. Like, am I 10 years in recovery? Are there things that are going to rub off on her? I'm like, I don't know those things. So it'll be, I don't know, just trusting my wife, who is, quote, a normal eater from what I know. To a certain extent, I think I am at this point as well, but I don't know. Things just kind of seem weird when there's a little you running around.
That actually sounds like a good topic for a future episode. I know you're actually not alone in that. We've heard a lot of people in our support groups express similar sentiments about not wanting to pass along their eating disorders.
I think it'll definitely be a topic on a future episode. So what are we talking about today?
So for our topic today, we actually reached out to a bunch of our listeners and actually Joy Project group members. We did a poll and asked what topics people were most interested in hearing about. And today's was the winner. And additionally, this topic idea actually came from a conversation I was having recently with other advocates online. And the subject is whether or not we should, as a community, be aiming for a singular approach that works for everyone, treatment-wise. And when I was talking to this other person online, their opinion was that we should be, and that it is more efficient, and that it prevents conflict within the community.
So what approaches you're talking about, like
treatment,
dialectical behavioral therapy,
yeah,
as a treatment?
Well,
I forget, which was the one that when I was in treatment was CBT.
Yep,
was what I did in Fargo.
Yeah. Well, the one that this particular advocate was advocating for was a treatment that solely focuses on weight restoration first, above all else.
Okay.
Which is kind of problematic when you realize that eating disorders don't always start with weight restoration. Yeah. And their reasoning...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What if... I mean, so there's different types of eating disorders as well. So if it's not...
Yeah.
Like, weight isn't an... I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just I'm keeping up here. Okay.
Yeah. This particular advocate is a firm believer that eating disorders are caused by, you know, a starved brain, and that is what drives the symptoms. So their belief is that if you get people eating, that they suddenly won't have an eating disorder again, which I do think that, I mean, I think we all know, like, once you get to a place where your brain is not fueled properly, you don't think the same, and it does have an impact.
Although
I do wonder how they think people started eating disorders to begin with, because people don't start at a low weight. they get there eventually.
Yeah.
And people also relapse once they have been weight restored. And it's interesting, this person also, the interesting thing that they were advocating for was they had all these examples of where people had gone to treatment and their treatment was focused on trying to resolve the root cause. You know, a lot of it was like looking at trauma, and a lot of these people didn't want to look at their trauma, which I think is a very valid point. I think in many cases that may not be appropriate for people. But where my opinion would lie is maybe that's not the right treatment for that person. And it's interesting because this other advocate's perspective was we should not ever allow that kind of treatment for anyone because it didn't work for that person. And
okay.
And to me, like, the analogy that pops up in my mind is like if we have a room full of people and we have all size 7 shoes, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's people who are like, this fits perfectly. This is wonderful. And there's other people who are like, these don't fit my feet. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, the logical conclusion would be we need different sizes of shoes to fit all the different feet.
Oh, silly Joy. No.
But this other advocate is like, everyone needs a size 9.
We need to do binding are their feet.
Right.
You have to bind the feet to make them fit with the shoe, of
size
course.
Size 7, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so...
Oh, boy.
I mean, in short, we did not...
Yeah.
I mean, I do want to say that I appreciate their enthusiasm and I think their heart was in the right place. I just don't agree with the conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the other option or the other options would be, it seems simple to me, and I'm not as involved in this as you are, but could we ask the individual what works for them? Okay. So So if we ask the individual what works for them, they would be like, well, I don't want to go into the treatment because I don't have an eating disorder and I want to be as eating disordered as possible. Right. So that could be it. So, right. So their brain might not be functioning to the base to begin with. Mm-hmm. And neither was mine at that point.
And there are other people right? who are like, I desperately want treatment because
yeah.
I'm very much
exactly.
suffering
Good
and
point.
I feel stuck. Uh-huh. And all I want is someone to support me.
I mean, first step, assess the individual and then kind of see what works for them.
Yeah.
A friend that I was going to treatment with, it feels like every time a close friend of mine was doing trauma work in treatment, she was just like, I just want to focus on eating first and getting to my weight and... Mm-hmm. Ignoring trauma has been working for me for a while. I just want to keep that going for a little bit, and then maybe we can try something else later.
And I think that's entirely right? valid. And on the flip side, I've also seen other people, and I've seen this more than once, and it actually kind of breaks my heart when it happens. A lot of trauma survivors, particularly different kinds of childhood abuse, would act out... Oh, how do I say this? Do we even want to go down this route? A lot of people who have gone through, like, child sexual abuse actually become hypersexual and act
okay.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And their eating disorder was a way of suppressing their sexuality in a way that made them not act on impulses.
Sure. Okay.
And so I've actually seen more than one person who goes to treatment and says, my eating disorder helps me suppress this and keeps me safe from that. And the treatment center would then be, well, we're going to get you weight restored and then turn you out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this vicious cycle of their sexual impulses have returned once
yeah.
their weight restored, but they never addressed the trauma. And so then there would be this acting out, and then they go back to their eating disorder, and it was just this endless loop, an endless cycle. And until they actually addressed the trauma, this person was just getting set up to fail over and over.
Okay. I think it's pretty clear that one size doesn't fit all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in much of anything in life. In treatment, it worked well for me. I feel like I made the most of it trying to do what I wanted to do, and friends that were, you know, in the same group as I was going through it just clashed. They clashed with the aides, with the nurses, with what level they were on, and they didn't want to talk about this during therapy. I just felt like maybe there was a different option for them, or maybe they weren't ready, or I didn't know what it was, but for me, the first time, so I was in treatment twice in 2008 and 2010, and the first time I feel like I just buzzed through. I did the worksheets, and I did the talk therapy. It went great, and I was out in a couple months, and I was cured until I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's how it goes for a lot of people, too, and it wasn't until the second time where I was like, okay, I need to take more stock in how I'm doing and figure out what I want to get out of this and what works for me. And other people I was in treatment with just seemed to have, you know, a difficult time with that. And I really felt for them. I felt for them too, because it is tough if you're not sure what works. You know, if they're trying to tell you one thing and then you keep saying, I don't want to talk about this. Now is not the right time for me to talk about this. Please don't make me talk about this. Mm-hmm. And the next question is, let's talk about your dad. Let's talk about your mom. And you're like, nope, I'm out. I'm done. I'm not eating for the weekend. I'm off.
Yep.
So, and that's the way it goes for some people. So I think, mm-hmm. you know, Joy, we've got to talk to survivors. We've got to talk to the people that are into it and figure out what works for them and how we can accommodate. Okay. You also mentioned something earlier. I mean, certain treatment centers have their model, mm-hmm. and if you don't like their model, then you're welcome to go to another treatment center, but they've had success with this model, and that's what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, I think ultimately it comes down to like what form and what function an eating disorder has for each individual person. There are definitely people who fit into the category of, you know, the stereotype of I just can't eat, you know, like and we see this a lot of times with like the restrictive anorexic type who, you know, maybe fit the genetic profile of, you know, they're very bright, they're very well-rounded in other ways, but they find that not eating actually helps kind of quiet the sensory overload that they might otherwise be feeling, and that mm-hmm. very much for them feels very biologically driven. And then there's other people whose eating disorder is very much rooted in trauma, or a really common example is people who are environments where they feel like they are not being heard, like they have no voice, they can't speak, and mm-hmm. they have all these emotions that have to go somewhere. And so they find that either not eating or like binging and purging, or, you know, just plain binging kind of muffles all of those emotions that they can't express elsewhere. And it's really self-medicating that. I've also seen a lot of people, I think it's incredibly common in binge eating disorder, and also on the flip side of very strong, like restrictive types, where there's a lot of trauma from childhood, and they find that trying to be unattractive physically as possible actually helps mm-hmm. keep them feeling safe.
Yeah.
Because they feel like people will avoid them and ignore
this,
them.
This broke my heart. I was the only guy in my treatment group. And it was myself and maybe a dozen young women, 15 to probably 60. Hearing these stories absolutely changed my life. And hearing what they'd gone through. And like you said, there's different types of trauma all around. And there's different types of personalities. But some of these stories, it just never crossed my mind as, you know, a guy in his early 20s. I'm like, oh, I never thought about that before. I never thought how, you know, what I said or did to an individual or an ex could have, you know, could have complicated that. Mm-hmm. It was really eye-opening. And yeah, I absolutely agree with you too. Like the varieties of eating disorders and the experiences and how people use food and control and in different ways to just help themselves survive day to day, I think is what it is. And then, you know, treatment coming in and saying, we're going to make this more difficult, but we want to make it better in the long run. So bear with us for a little while. And it's an absolute trust. And I feel like you really need to trust your therapist and your treatment center. Mm-hmm. And some people just aren't there yet.
Right.
Because they've had that trust build up and broken, or never had it so many times in their life that they're not ready to go to that place yet.
Yeah.
And that's understandable too. And it just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have no answers. No answers. I'm just talking.
Right.
But yeah. It's,
mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting that in the field of advocates, it's very easy and everybody always agrees that eating disorders are complex and they're multifaceted, and there's no one way that people get eating disorders. But then for some reason, when it comes to treatment, they think that everyone's going to be the same, and it just really isn't the case.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, where's the research on this, though? I mean, we're in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I mean, the University of Minnesota does a ton of research on eating disorders, yeah. Probably one of the preeminent in the world coming out of down the road.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, there is a lot of research. Like, for example, one of the things that has been researched quite a lot in the past few years is family-based therapy. And it's been researched a lot because it works in many cases. And it's cheaper to, you know, treat a person at home than always an inpatient. Okay. And it also, especially if you have children, you know, if you take them out and treat them in the hospital and then put them back in the same environment where they got sick in, it's not always going to work.
Yeah.
But the research also does show that there are certain people for whom family-based treatment actually has very terrible outcomes. And it usually is based on different underlying issues around family functioning.
Of course.
And about like whether parents allow like psychological autonomy in their children.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
So is their approach, I mean, not their approach, not like the FBT approach, but just general treatment, do they usually try one first, and then if that doesn't work, go on to the next one and go on to the next one? Mm-hmm. Kind of like if I'm going to the ER, they're going to try Tylenol first, and then if that doesn't work, they're going to try something else, and then try something else. So is there always like one that they try first, or is it just...
I think
whichever one their therapists are most comfortable with for the individual.
I mean, for most people, it really is just kind of whatever treatment center you go to, you get their approach.
So what's the contention here then, right? So you said you were talking to someone and they were like, this works for everyone.
Or
what? Like,
well, their agreement or argument is that we should discontinue anything that didn't work for the people they know and choose one method.
Oh.
And their issue was that we should be uniform across all treatment centers so that wherever you go, you will always get the same treatment. And so that there's less controversy among researchers and less controversy.
The face I'm making, hopefully I'll have an emoji in the show notes so everyone can see that. it seems odd. Surely that can't be it though, right?
Well, you know, what's interesting about this is
It seems too simple.
Yes, and also what's ironic about it is there's a lot of controversy over whether or not families impact their eating disorder children, and I think it's pretty clear that eating disorders are not something that, you know, the family does one thing and the child ends up with an eating disorder. That never happens.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of families who are just absolutely amazing, have always been supportive, they've done nothing wrong. And I don't want to demonize anyone, but there are other families where people with eating disorders say that when their family has impacted their eating disorder, it's because their family has adopted a strategy where conflict is not allowed. We all need to find one position and agree on it. If you don't agree with it, you need to get out. And conflict is not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is this seems to be playing out. But, you know, a lot of advocates are actually following this pattern.
Okay.
Which is really interesting to me.
Sounds like bullying.
Kind of. And in a lot of cases, I think...
Especially, I need to clarify, I mean, especially for individuals, survivors from eating disorders who have been in that position. And actually, this is directly in our last episode, too. Mm-hmm. Talking about self-advocacy, talking about finding your voice. And Joy talked about how she was, you know, struggling to find her place, to be more vocal, to be about how you struggled with your family, trying to, you know, fit the mold of who they wanted you to be.
Mm-hmm.
I feel for these individuals who try and express themselves and who are trying to find out who they are in these ages. I mean, it feels like you're just coming out of a cocoon. That's how it felt for me when I was going through my eating disorder and coming out and just being like, okay, I remember trying to remember who I was back when I was 16. That's not the person I am now. I'm 24. Who am I? What do I do? What are the things that I believe in? Right? Mm-hmm. Who do I want to vote for?
Right.
What's happening, you know? And we just need to allow more space for those individuals to grow. I keep saying I don't know, but part of the reason why I like this show is because we don't have direct answers.
Mm-hmm.
We just ask questions. We're not professionals. We're not going to say you need to do this or you need to do that. We just want to talk about what a lot of other people are kind of going through. And I feel like being bullied into you need to do something this way, you need to do something that way, is hurtful. It's hurtful for me to hear that it might be happening as well. But so, I mean, maybe just more space to talk about things, or more voices need to be heard. I mean, do we need to hear from more, obviously need to hear from more survivors?
Yeah. And I think one of the, you know, if we take an example of, if there's a treatment program that fits, you know, the old school stereotype of the doctors who say, we're the experts, you have an eating disorder, we can't trust you because you're going to try to, you know, fight for your eating disorder. So we need to watch you every second. You need to comply with the rules. There are definitely some people in this world for whom that is the ideal approach. These are the people who they're just frustrated. They've tried everything. They don't know what, you know, which end is up. They're like, just tell me what to do and I will do it because I am so lost. Like, please help me, save me from my eating disorder. And for them, that approach is perfect. And there's also the ones who are like, I really want to recover, but wow, I still want my eating disorder and it is going to fight tooth and nail and I'm going to lie. And, you know, and there are people, that's absolutely going to be the right approach for them. But there are other people who have used their eating disorder because in their day-to-day life, they feel they have no voice. They've been told that they're not allowed to speak up about their needs. They have to be compliant at all times. They have to please people at all times. And their eating disorder is kind of their one way that they can channel all of that somewhere. And so if you take that person and put them in that environment, where then you are also telling them they can't argue back, they can't tell you how they feel, they have to comply, they have to just stifle every emotion and just go along with it, I don't know that that's actually fixing anything. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the secondary thing of, it's one thing to get people, you know, weight restored or, you know, nutrition restored if they don't need to be weight restored, just get them back, interrupt symptoms, which is a good thing. But a lot of treatment programs will stop there, you know, like just follow your meal plan, do as you're told.
Oh, yeah.
But it's very different, you know, for learning to comply with someone telling you what to do versus knowing how to feed yourself.
Yeah.
How to recognize if you're hungry.
So then if you get to that point where you've been, all right, I've been following the meal plan, I've been writing down the charts and everything, it's time for me to go back to college and live in a dorm, or to go back to my family and live with, you know, my husband and do this on myself, do this by myself. What's the aftercare of a situation like that like?
Yeah. Like, maybe a good analogy, you know, if we use, like, your young daughter, like, if she's learning how to walk, do you stand there and put her legs in braces and manually move them, you know, one foot after another, you know?
Honestly, I don't know. We haven't got to this spot yet. I'll probably Google it when the time... my instinct is going to say no to the braces.
Probably not, yeah. I mean, you know, she'll get the feel of how it feels for walking.
Yeah, really great. Yeah, like, if I hold her up right now, she kind of, like... I feel like there's, like, pressure on my chest and stuff when I hold her up, and she's kind of getting things about her.
Yeah. Like, it can still be helpful. She can still learn from that. But what's actually going to develop her muscles to be able to hold herself while she's walking, and that's, you know, you just giving her a little bit of a boost, but giving her space to make mistakes, you know, catching her if she falls, making sure nothing's in her way, but also letting her do the work herself. And I think that's... important.
That just sounds like it would take so much more time, Joy. It sounds like it's just so much more labor intensive.
I mean, it very possible. Well, in the short term, it sounds that way. I think a lot of people, when they think about what kind of treatment programs work, they think that someone is sick right now. We need to make them unsick as fast as possible. But I think for me, it's not just that, but it's also, we need to get them well in a way that's also sustainable. And in a way
that they can take care of themselves.
That they can take care of themselves.
They're walking by themselves, take the training wheels off.
Yep.
That type of thing.
Because, I mean, if we, you know, just step in and force people to change all of their behaviors while we, you know, stand over and watch them, we may very well get them to change their behaviors, but are they just going to relapse immediately? Are they going to drop out of treatment? Like, if they don't stay in treatment, if they can't maintain the change, then it really wasn't effective. I mean, it may have saved their life in the interim, but it just wasn't affected then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a natural extension of this is I've heard a lot of advocates, particularly in the parent advocacy community for some reason, who are really, really pushing for the narrative that people with eating disorders have flawed brains. They can't speak for themselves. They can't be trusted. Decisions need to be made for them because their brains can't be trusted. And I think there are definitely situations, like, for example, if someone, you know, if you ask someone if they're fat and they clearly think they are, like, yes, their brain is maybe not working correctly in mm-hmm. that arena. But if someone comes to a treatment program and you're trying to take away what is essentially their security blanket, especially if it's, you know, trauma-based eating disorders, and this person is like, I have no voice, like, my family's in shambles, I'm terrified, I don't know how to ask for what I need. And if the treatment program then is like, okay, you need to stop talking about all of that and just follow the program.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's helpful. And I think in a lot...
like that.
Yeah,
and that's exactly. Super annoying. You like, almost jumped over the table at me.
I know. I'm like, what are you doing? Yeah. No, but for real. And I think in a lot of cases, like, legitimate concerns that people have where they're actually like, I am here in treatment because I want to recover. Mm-hmm. I'm desperately trying. I'm paying a lot of money for this. I'm, you know, showing up every day. And I'm telling you that this thing that you're doing is actually making it more difficult mm-hmm. or that what I really need is support in this other area because that is what's kicking my butt right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's unfortunate that a lot of treatment programs will then turn around and say, well, this is our program. And
maybe that's just your eating disorder talking.
That's just your eating disorder talking.
Ooh.
You know, but it's also a really tricky line because in some cases, it may be their eating disorder.
In some cases, it is.
Yeah. It's a delicate
just back to
art.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a really well-trained person to be able to kind of feel people out, to be like, uh-huh. is this really their eating disorder talking? Or is this a person with a legitimate concern?
I feel like this leads me again to believing that generalizations and assumptions and the one size fits all
doesn't work.
Yeah.
Well, it's very...
To the individual, it's easy for us, you know, advocates in the community to talk about this stuff on a large scale.
Mm-hmm.
And Joy certainly has a lot of experiences and stories of people that you've gotten to know. And I've got friends that have also gone through treatment. We are talking about their personalities, their experiences. I think it's just important to keep that in mind, that these are all people we've known, which is why we do this, because we want the best for them. And I think in doing that, we need to get to know them, but they should be allowed to make those decisions. And I don't think their hands should be tied by any larger organization that says, you need to go along this path and you need to go along this path.
Uh-huh.
I think they need to be allowed to say, listen, I've got an individual here that she needs to be at home with her mom and needs to be helped out in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And another person saying, listen, this daughter and her dad are just volatile. She needs to be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we just need to be putting more trust in treatment teams.
Mm-hmm.
And that their knowledge, they've known more people than I have, probably known more people than Joy has. They do this day in and day out, and provided they're good at what they do, they should know the best course of treatment for these individuals, I hope.
As much as
they're allowed to do, and as much as the individual is mm-hmm. is capable of assisting with that. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And I do also recognize that there are, you know, valid logistical concerns. Like, you can't just have a free-for-all in every treatment program. Like, there has to be some sort of structure. But I do think that even just, you know, 5 or 6 general methodology options mm-hmm. would get us much further than just a single one. Because, you know, if you have someone who's incredibly shy and incredibly anxious, like, they're going to need a different approach than someone who is, you know, impulsive and like, please settle me down, like, mm-hmm. please help me control myself, you know, as someone who's like combative versus someone who's always compliant. Like, those are going to be issues that I think will require a completely different approach.
Yeah.
And we need to make that accessible.
Hopefully we have a lot of different listeners from a lot of different backgrounds. If this, you know, is something that you'd want to weigh in on, or something you agree with, or
give us some feedback. We have a Facebook page, Eating Disorders Off Topic. Feel free to give us your opinion, your story. We'd love to hear it.
Like I said before, it's not about finding the perfect answer for Joy and I. It's kind of just opening up
the conversation.
Opening up the conversation, and sometimes we hear, we can't talk about that, or we should maybe save that conversation for another time. This is the other time. So this is now. So
we're on topic.
So if you have an opinion or want to get to us or have just compliments, we'd love to hear how you think we're doing. So we're going to take a short break, and then we will be back with our next topic. Thank you.
Oh, have you seen it just dropped season 2 Shrill on HBO? We were talking about the... It's a great show. She is a fat woman who was working at a magazine, and she wrote like an article. It's a fiction story, but she wrote an article in the magazine in the show, and then she got kicked out. And then it kind of like explores her life as a fat individual. And one of the great scenes that I think we were talking about is the pool party that she got invited to, the fat positivity pool party. And people were just like, really? You can show that.
Mm-hmm. Representation.
Representation matters. And it was super popular.
Mm-hmm.
Shrill was. And it's on season 2. And I really liked it. My wife and I almost watched the whole thing when it came out. So, yeah, definitely check that out. I think we both really enjoyed it. I've been trying to figure out a good way of contextualizing this and setting it up last time, being like, all right, we're going to talk about intimacy and how body image may play a factor in that, especially if you're with an individual who's not familiar with eating disorders. Specifically, this was brought to mind myself when I was probably seeing my girlfriend, my wife now. She was trying to make a move on me on the couch. I just recoiled and I was like, oh, we're not gonna do that. I really liked her. She was great. We were probably together for a few months, and she was like reaching for my abdomen to pull me closer. And that was like a trouble area for me, that I felt like uncomfortable with somebody touching my torso. She just like recoiled and she was like, I'm so sorry. I thought I was feeling something from you. I didn't mean to, you know, go that far. And I had to explain to her that wasn't the issue. I was like, I really like you. And it's just, I'm trying to get more comfortable with my body and being in recovery. And I've gained some weight. I've lost some weight. I've gained some weight. And just trying to be comfortable with where I'm at. And I feel like it was tough to navigate around, because normally nonverbal signals can be pretty straightforward. Like if somebody were to reach for you and you were just like, ooh, no, thank you, that'd be like, no, don't do that again. Mm-hmm. But I had to explain to Caitlin, I was like, well, let's try and go more slowly here. It was tough. And still, I was talking with Joy and I'm like, why does this take so long to shake? Why does it take so long to shake the body image thing off? Because I'm pretty good eating regularly. I've been in long-term recovery for quite a while, but sometimes it's just like getting out of the shower and be like, nah, I don't feel like looking at the mirror today. I'm just gonna, that's not the day I'm having. And it snaps back and I think, is this a relapse moment? And like all these thoughts start coming in. I'm like, nope, no. We need to back up here.
I mean, I think what's coming to my mind is you're saying that, other than like relating to a lot of it, you know, from like my own past relationships and in recovery, I don't think it's an all or nothing thing. I mean, I think in general, coming to terms with getting comfortable in different situations is a very situational thing. Maybe an analogy is, you know, I have a friend who got sober. You know, of course, getting sober was the hard thing, but then getting comfortable in social situations was another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was something about, you know, going to work sober that he had to work through. But then different pieces are harder along the way for him to be able to go to a bar and be sober was yeah. like one of the harder things. And I think in terms of just volume of exposure to things in recovery, we get pretty good at, you know, walking around during the day and seeing members of the general mm-hmm. public. I mean, we do it every day. You know, we get to go to the grocery store and know that, like, our body is fine enough. Like, nothing's going to happen,
yep.
you know. But then when it's just you and one other person, and especially if it's a time when you're really trying to connect with someone and it really matters, if you haven't done a lot of that, like, that's always going to be more challenging. And I don't think it necessarily means that you've relapsed. I think it's just that this situation is more challenging than most.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also in terms of body image, a lot of times when we have our worst body image, we are only looking at pieces. You know, we're not remembering that, like, we're a person with friends. We're a person who does good things at work. Like, we think, I'm looking in the mirror at this body part and judging this yeah. body part against, you know, all of society's expectations, out of context, mm-hmm. everywhere else. And I think it's much easier to get really negative about that because you forget everything else in recovery that balanced it out.
Yeah.
You know.
So, Caitlin said earlier that I told her that I had an eating disorder on, like, our second or third date or something. I think that's just where I was at the time. And I think that helped us along the way and it helped her understand if it kind of took me longer to get somewhere. So maybe, like, kissing instead of being physical with the bodies or telling her something or doing so, finding another one of those, like, love languages to let her know that I cared about her without challenging myself enough yet. And then when I felt more comfortable with her, it was challenging my own physical space, whether it was sitting beside her on the couch and then having her touch my thigh, which was kind of a trouble spot for me. And I'm like, okay, hopefully she can just touch my thigh and then she won't run away, but I'm just gonna, like, sit through this. And she didn't know that I was just, like, going through some shit at that moment. And just deep breaths, okay, and thinking to myself, this is what it means to her, and she's showing affection for me. I don't have a background of physical or sexual abuse, so I can't speak to that part of it, which I understand that would be much more probably deeply involved with people with a history of that, just speaking of my background. So it took me a little longer to accept those romantic touches on parts of my body that I was uncomfortable with. And I was lucky to have a woman who really cared for me and was able to kind of take those slow steps with me, even though sometimes she was super surprised if I would just jump and be like, what are you doing? If I was surprised, you know, like, I'm in the shower and she opened the shower curtain. If she was trying to be sexy, I'd be like, no, we're not going to do any of that. No.
I need to
hide first. Yep. I'm going to take a moment. Let me cover myself in soap so nobody can see me.
Right.
You know,
but when you really think about it though, if you really think about it, it's not really that surprising that it's really difficult. So if you think about all the major challenges of recovery and, you know, owning yourself and facing your fears, those situations are really, all of those aspects are present. One is, will I be accepted for me?
Mm-hmm.
Fear
yeah.
of rejection. Can I actually connect with someone?
Like, I've been rejecting myself because of these exact same issues for so long. I've yeah. rejected myself because of the way I looked or the way I thought or the things that I did. Is she going to reject me too?
Yeah. It's also, if I have a need that differs with what, you know, society tells me I should need, how do I advocate for that and say, like, you know what, I really like you, but I don't want you to touch me in this area because it's a hard part for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think there's a lot of also internal, you know, judgment of, like, well, society says I should like this and I don't. So, and I, you know, I don't want to piss anybody off and I want to make everybody happy. So, it kind of follows along with the whole, like, people pleasing eating disorder thing. If you yourself haven't come to terms with everything, like, personally, it makes sense that you would be like, I can't accept these. So how can someone else accept it?
Yeah.
You know? But it can be actually really liberating, like, when you actually do put yourself in that situation and realize, like, the other person's like, this is cool. You're awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it can be really healing too. But it's a risk. If
yeah.
you do put yourself in that situation and somebody reacts poorly, like, that's terrifying.
Do you divulge to people that you date your background that you've had an eating disorder?
I usually do. And, I mean, I've been recovered for a long time, so it's not normally like a must tell them in the first date kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Although, because I run, you know, the Joy Project, like that comes up, you know, what do you do in your spare time kind mm-hmm. of, and that we usually start the conversation that way. Otherwise, just as I get to know people and when people kind of let down their guard and say like, you know, these are the things I struggle with in life, like this is my story, like mm-hmm. it usually comes out. And I've been recovered long enough to know when I need someone to know something.
So it's not, yeah, not as early on. I think early in my recovery when I was dating, it was hiding right away because I was worried of that rejection. I was worried that something was wrong with me, mm-hmm. that they're dating someone who might have to go back to treatment or might be weird around food, or they can't go out to eat with me because I have an eating disorder, so they're just going to be mm-hmm. weird around food and me for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So I was worried about that happening. And the more I was, you know, became comfortable with myself and who I was in recovery, I just got comfortable revealing it. And I think that was important for me too, to say, this is who I'm going to be. So we need to get comfortable with this. Mm-hmm. As it progressed too, with regard to intimacy in the first part, sometimes things did take longer to be okay with. You know, just being like, okay, we need the covers on at all times, and I need to be covered up during sex, and we can't have the lights on because I don't want to see parts of myself. And to where other times, like, if I became closer with someone, feeling more liberated in those atmospheres and being more comfortable with them, but also with myself, and mm-hmm. saying, okay, this is, I'm more comfortable with myself about this. So, mm-hmm. and a lot of that is difficult because it might get crossed in communication with, you know, my partner, maybe saying, is it because they don't want to see me? Is it because they don't like me? Mm-hmm. And I think it all just comes down to communication in my experience and saying, why are these things happening and being open in your sexual relationships?
Yeah. And I think being able to be open actually will only benefit your relationship. I mean, first of all, it, you know, promotes understanding so that she knows, like, that's what's going on. It's mm-hmm. not me, you know, it's that. But also, it's a sign of trust when you can
yeah.
actually be a little bit vulnerable.
And not only did it feel, like, obviously, like, vulnerable physically, you know, you're vulnerable emotionally as well. In recovery, too, I felt, you know, also vulnerable that way. And so it was like, just, okay, here we go. And just kind of, and let that person know that there's a lot going on in your brain. Ultimately, I think Joy said something too here that was really facing fears like that and being uncomfortable. It's kind of
it's easier once you've done it once.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It gets easier. There are those, you know, moments where like, okay, going into the shower again, I'll be just fine. And walking past mirrors and stuff isn't so big of an issue for me, mm-hmm. but have my days and just kind of walk by them, mm-hmm. glance at myself and say, all right, I'm fully clothed today. Win. I got it done today for sure. And so it's been a really big journey, but the intimacy was something that I didn't expect. And nobody talked about it, you know, opened up about it to me. That was like, hey, this might be something that could trip you up mm-hmm. because don't expect it. You know, like I didn't expect it.
Right.
You expect to be in a sexual place with a person and for, you know, your body just to kind of like take control and have sex. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden, like a part in the back of your brain's like, whoa, 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 you do know you're going to be naked for this, right? And you're like, oh, fuck, shit, I'm going to be naked? Oh, no. And you're like, oh, wait. Okay, back up. No. Yeah, this was not part of the deal.
Right.
Yeah, so it was surprising. So then at the time, I'm like, okay, so maybe are other people going through this? I'm like, okay, so other people have probably gone through this too and have probably navigated it in a similar way. So I wanted to talk about it because I don't think there's shame in going through it. Even if you just generally have times when you're unsatisfied with your body, you can struggle, you know, with intimacy and, you know, being close to your partner in this. Yeah, like Joy said, just kind of practice in a safe spot with a partner you're comfortable with. And
yeah. And I think just recognize and honor the fact that as much as kind of like you said, when you're going into it, you're like, this shouldn't have been this hard. I should have been able to flip a switch and what's the problem?
Uh-huh. My body should be taking over.
Right. Exactly. Uh-huh. And I think that just comes down to expectations. And then, recognizing that, you know what, it really isn't that easy. And that's okay that it's not that easy. It just, it is what it is. It's a process, and you just need to take one experience at a time and kind of gain confidence through that. That's just where it's at.
Very good. Excellent. I think we can end there. Joy said it best. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll have...
Talk about our next episode.
Talk about our next episode. For our next show, I think we really wanted to talk about fitness and what it means to fitness and exercise, and if, how, when, how much, too long, if you can, all those types of things.
Whether or not we need a new word.
Whether or not we need a new word between fitness and fitness, and what it means in recovery or your eating disorder, you know, and... again, we probably won't answer some questions, but we're definitely going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And compare society's definition of fitness versus an eating disorder recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't like the word fitness, but...
Right?
Yeah, we need a new word.
Fitness.
But you know what we're talking about, right?
We're going to talk about ED and vitality.
Yes. Yes. Basic general, you know, well-being and health and what it actually means as compared to what society tells us it means.
I like that. Another topic we're going to be talking about is... Wait, what was the other one?
We actually have several topics.
Or the one that was on the poll.
Was...
Do you remember?
We have a few. There was eating... or exercise and recovery. There was trauma treatment and eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Healthy eating versus recovery eating.
Ooh. Yeah. We should do that one next episode.
Yeah.
So next episode, we want to talk about healthy eating versus recovery eating. Was this what it was?
Basically about, like, when you go through eating disorder recovery and you learn what healthy is and you learn how to eat and you learn how to recognize when you're hungry and stop when you're full, and then you go out in society and are bombarded by messages about this is what healthy is and how they conflict and how to deal with that.
Oh, yeah. That'll be good.
Yeah.
I will tune in.
Plan.
we'll have our next one out soon, and thank you again. You can check out our show notes for more information about the Joy Project, and then
and feel free to visit our Facebook page, and we are open to suggestions for future topic ideas. We're happy to discuss whatever you guys want to hear about.
That is it. We want to thank you again for listening to us, for being a part of our day. Thank you for inviting us into your ears. Thank you very much.